This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick is coming to Valparaiso University this evening, and we'll find out why in a conversation with Laurie Snell and Ann Wodeski. They'll be involved in an organization bringing the Superintendent of Public Instruction to the region. We'll also hear more about an unusual museum that is set up in Indiana that deals with medical issues and why it's needing support. And also, we all have to have conversation with an official from Gary City Hall about a very special ceremony that happened in front of the City Hall today. Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick is making a stop at Valparaiso University today as part of a statewide tour of communities. A Northwest Indiana group of educators invited Dr. McCormick to speak at their fall 2017 teacher and community public meeting that gets underway today at 5 o'clock local time. And with us to talk more about the visit of Superintendent McCormick to Valparaiso University, we have to find out more about the organization that she is going to visit and take part in this very special seminar today. We're talking with Laurie Snell, who's the director of the Professional Educators Partnership. And along with Laurie, we have Ann Wodeski, who is the principal of Parkview Elementary School in Valparaiso. She is the chairman of the steering committee for the PEP. Ladies, thank you very much for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for this opportunity to share what we're all about.
Well, I'll kind of open up the question, I guess, maybe explain, if you will, Laurie Snell, what the PEP is all about.
Back in 2001, the teacher education department had concerns about how can we strengthen the rapport and the relations that we have with the schools that we work with. People are familiar with student teaching experiences, but within our teacher ed program, there are many courses that we wanted our students to be in the classroom. And so how could we reach out to these schools that we're working with to have a professional learning community, to have it more of a give and take rather than depositing our students out in the schools? And so that was our concern. A lot of big state institutions have lab schools on campus, and we don't have that, not going that direction. So this was something that we developed in not really knowing, you know, it's a model. It really is a grassroots program that we created. And it has transpired into some really great opportunities for both the university and the K-12 school community. It truly is a partnership. The steering committee, Ann, is our chairman of the steering committee. And then we have an elementary group that meets. We have a middle-level group and a high school group. But this meeting coming up is our kickoff of the year, so it's our first meeting that we bring all levels together for a meeting. And the steering committee decided last spring that it would be great if we could have the state superintendent, since she's new to office, to come and give us those updates. And so I invited her, and we are thrilled that she has accepted our invitation to come to campus.
When you talk about the Professional Educators Partnership and the importance of the organization, and you talk about the fact that there aren't that many laboratory schools out there, I guess the only one that really comes to mind when it comes to education is the Burris Lab School in Muncie, because it's right in the aegis of Ball State University's Department of Education there. So there probably aren't many examples like that. Can you take examples like the existing laboratory schools that are around and help put that together, or have you done that in putting that together, and what information that you like to share as far as the Professional Educators Partnership is concerned?
We are really in a unique situation, and when we were doing our research to sort of develop the partnership, we really couldn't find a model that we liked. So we created our own, which makes it truly grassroots, and over time, several other smaller institutions have come to us and said, how did you get this going, and how do you get... we have between 800 to 1,000 practicing teachers and administrators that come to us throughout the year for different things that we sponsor. So this is just one of many things that we sponsor throughout the year.
When you talk about offering opportunities for educators to get together and learn things, it's obviously a professional improvement type role, is it not? Something that's akin to what other professions happen to have?
Yes, and so what has transpired with the elementary group, we put on a literacy workshop every fall. And over the years, it continues to grow. And I will let Ann Wodeski, since she is an elementary principal, sort of talk about our literacy workshop that we have every fall and it is coming up October 10th.
Okay, great. Right ahead, Ann.
Yeah, we are really excited. Like Laurie said, we have on October 10th, we have Who's Doing the Work. The authors of that book will be Jan Burris and Kim Yaris, and they're going to be sharing with elementary teachers and administrators. And this is just a very well-attended event in the whole region. We have people coming from all over to join in, and that's pretty much been the tradition, as we not only get to network with each other on that day, but we get to learn from experts in the area of literacy. So we're super excited. I think the event's almost sold out, but that will be October 10th from 8:30 to 2:45.
Can you go online to find out more about it?
Yes, all of our events, if you go to valpo.edu/pep, P-E-P, that will take you to our page on the university website. And so it has all the information about our upcoming events and registration information. The other two events that we host, our secondary group in December as a PLC workshop. And this year, even though it's hosted by our high school group, they sort of direct us with the agenda. It is open to K-12, and we're talking about innovative learning in a digital world. All of the schools at all levels are facing those challenges of what is good practice with integrating technology into the school system.
We're talking with Laura.
So the PLC workshop, we are excited. We have two of we're having actually four mini keynote speakers, and two of them are Apple Distinguished Educators. And what that means is every 2 years, Apple recruits teachers that are highly effective and that are really the true teacher leaders in their schools, and they get this recognition. They develop a cohort, and every 2 years they have about 20 teachers across the nation that get together and try to make this shift of moving the curriculum to one-to-one. So Jenny Majera and Kristen Zemke are two Apple Distinguished Educators that will be on that agenda. And then we also have Josh Stumpenhorst, who has been recognized as Illinois Teacher of the Year, and he is also an ISTE Emergent Leader. And ISTE is one of the top tech professional educators in our field. Mm-hmm. So he will be there. And then we also will have on the agenda Jason Markey. And he was recognized in 2014 as Digital Principal Award winner and also as a Google Certified Teacher. So we have all perspectives from elementary to high school to the administrative perspective of how do we make this shift with technology in the classroom.
That sounds great.
Josh Stumpenhorst is also a middle-level teacher in Naperville, and he has done an innovative day that has sort of, he goes across the nation now and talks about Innovation Day that he has developed in his school.
Well, that's great to hear.
Two of those speakers also have TED Talks. Jenny has a TED Talk, The Power to the Pupil. And Josh has a TED Talk on a classroom-led solution for changing your school system. So we're really excited. All of them have publications and blogs, and that's one of the unique things when I bring in people. We want them, teachers and principals, to be able to come for that day of learning, but to be able to extend that learning either through these resources of their publications or their blogs or their website so that the learning can continue after they visit campus for those days.
That's great. Now, once again, where is this and when is this going to happen, this seminar talking about education in the digital age?
It will also take place at Valparaiso University on campus at the Hari Union, and that one is December 6th.
Oh, good.
Registration will open in October for that event.
Well, good. Something to look forward to here. We're talking with Laurie Snell, who is the director of the Professional Educators Partnership, and with her is Ann Waletsky, who is the principal at Parkview Elementary School in Valparaiso, and Ann is the chairperson for the steering committee for the PEP. We're looking now in particular about a visit today by the state superintendent of public instruction, McCormick, coming into Valparaiso University. Tell us what Dr. McCormick is going to be focusing on as she has her visit today.
Well, we have submitted some questions. We've asked our teachers and our leadership groups to come forward and ask some questions. And I think one of the big focuses is really accountability and school improvement. kind of taking a look at getting to know Dr. McCormick and what are her long-term goals as we develop a partnership. And then also there's, you know, we're going to take a look at assessment, funding, and supporting education with students, academics, and school funding.
Of course, school funding is always a very touchy issue. It's not only teachers and other administrators, but, of course, school board members that are very concerned about where the funding is going to come from. When you have a funding system that is set up basically through the state of Indiana, it'll be interesting to see what discussions come out of that. And I'm sure, too, that probably the latest discussions in this transition between the ISTEP exam and the new ILEARN exam is going to be one of those that will be brought up. I'm sure that Dr. McCormick will probably have an update on that, too, I would think.
Most definitely.
That's great. Well, it sounds like it's going to be a very interesting session. It's going to be at 5:30 today. It's going to happen in the community room at the Christopher Center on the Valparaiso University campus. We've been talking with Lori Snell, who's the director of the Professional Educators Partnership, and with her, and Wodetsky, who's principal at Parkview Elementary School, who's a part of the organization, in fact, is the chair of the steering committee, about not only a very important but unique organization within the Northwest Indiana's world of education, but the Northwest region as well here across the Hoosier State. Ladies, thank you very much for spending time to talk with us. We welcome Dr. McCormick. She comes into the Valparaiso University campus day to talk about the subject's important. And I hope that you and all the other educators are going to be attending this conference today. We'll get something out of it to be able to take back to your classrooms or your school buildings and tell other people about. Thank you for spending time with us today to talk about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And reminder that Lori Snell and Ann Wodetsky are reminding attendees that today's program begins at 5:30 local time. It's been listed on the registration webpage as 6:30, which is not the right time. It's 5:30 local time today. Some of the challenges that the state faced with mental health in the 18 and 1900s are still being battled today. And the officials at One Indiana Museum believe that preserving the past is an important part for the future of medical treatment. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting Lindsay Wright reports, the museum has its own challenges in making that possible.
As you walk through Indiana's Medical History Museum, you'll see things like full-bodied skeletons, parts of the human brain, and autopsy tables. The museum transports you to the late 1800s when Central State Mental Hospital opened on the west side of Indianapolis.
So this is an aerial view of the hospital grounds that was taken in 1921.
While showing us around the building, Executive Director Sarah Halter points out where we are on an old map.
This is our building, 1896, the old pathology building.
Central State was one of the first progressive mental health hospitals of its kind. Halter says it opened during a time when medical professionals knew very little about mental disease.
And the idea was that they would treat these mental diseases as just that, a disease. You know, these were people who had something wrong with them that could potentially be fixed. These weren't people who were possessed by demons. They weren't innately bad people. They were real people, human beings who needed and deserved help. And so that was the idea.
So doctors and medical students from around the world would gather in this building for lectures, live autopsy demonstrations, and to conduct research about mental health. Halter says what makes the museum so rare, though, is that nearly everything is original. Medical equipment, test tubes and chemical bottles, and even furniture you see were used during the 18th and 19th century. Even photography played a large role at that time.
Photography was becoming an important part of medical education when this building opened, and they wanted to create teaching aids and supplement journal articles and kind of document their research. And then they were also using stereographs for teaching. They weren't producing the stereographs here, but they were purchasing them and then using them to share with students. This is a replica. If you would like to try it, the card itself is original. These were really popular items at the turn of the last century, late 19th century, early 20th century. This card is from 1910, and it shows a tertiary syphilis lesion on a man's foot.
The pathology building opened as a museum in 1968, but it wasn't until the 1990s that the hospital completely shut down, following abuse allegations and funding problems. Halter says the history serves an important purpose for the present and even future.
Not just this building, but the whole site, the whole former grounds of the hospital is kind of a tangible reminder of a time when, doctors were trying to get away from the idea that these these people were bad, that they should be treated like criminals, and kind of move towards treating them as people with diseases that could be helped.
It's an issue communities struggle with to this day as residents battle addiction and other mental health disorders. Not only are museum officials battling to preserve that history, they're also fighting to preserve the physical building that holds it. The building is funded primarily through donations and admission fees. Officials launched a capital campaign in 2015 to fix several issues with the roof, the HVAC, and electrical systems, among other things. But there is good news. The museum is already a third of the way to its goal with the campaign, and attendance has risen significantly in the last few years, anywhere from 10 to 25% each year since 2014.
We want to save this building. We want this building to still exist for future generations. It's an incredible piece of history, and if lost, it can't be replaced. So that's really our focus right now.
Last year, the museum welcomed 8,200 visitors. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
Now, Lindsay tells us that the museum still has a rather large collection of donated items in storage, and officials are hoping to be able to expand in the future by opening a more traditional-style museum. But for now, the focus is on saving the museum that's currently open. So there's a lot of work to be done, but they're taking it one step at a time, and they're being very optimistic about the future of the Medical History Museum. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, it's hard to believe that Social Security is 82 years old this year, but it is, the month of August, and of course it's a major part of many people's retirement plans, their lives, their livelihoods for some people. And while the government is telling us about problems with Social Security, it's still something to mark, and there's still a way you can take advantage of this and building it into your retirement plan. And of course that means we're turning to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer to tell us more about it. Greg, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us here first about the importance of Social Security for Hoosiers, at least.
It does represent a very large portion of retirement income for those folks in retirement. And in Indiana alone, the population of 65 and over, those receiving Social Security, is near 900,000 individuals. And Social Security lifts about 350,000 of those from an income level out of poverty.
When you deal with a lot of these things and dealing, of course, with the importance of Social Security as a major source of income for the elderly, you have to take into account a lot of strategies as well, too, to be able to make sure that if you do receive Social Security payments, that you in turn use the money wisely and can leverage it, I guess, against whatever investment that you have here. Tell us first here about how you can maximize your benefits if you do things right.
Yeah, there's a couple of different things to consider. One is just understanding that if you do take it early, you're reducing the benefit that you earn. That's one of the things I always encourage folks to understand. If you take it earlier than your full retirement age, let's say 62, you're only going to get 75% of the benefits that you earn through the Social Security system. Also, when you consider spousal benefits, potential widow benefits, divorce benefits, there's a lot of different things to consider for everybody's individual situation. But assuming that they continue with their normal expected inflation rate, choosing to collect early could cost thousands of dollars in benefits.
We didn't usually don't always mention about the fact that survivors, widows, survivors, family members and the like can be qualified because of maybe disabled or whatever it may be. They get to take advantage of Social Security benefits as well, too, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of exceptions to the rules, especially around the widows. And then also how you choose to elect those benefits in those situations, you have to consider the tax impact, because the taxes, whether your Social Security becomes reportable, is determined by all the other things that you're doing strategy-wise in terms of creating income from your other investments or other income sources.
Yeah. I know one of the other strategies that you talk about often with your clients is what you refer to as turning back the clock. Tell us what you mean by that and how that fits into this, especially with Social Security benefits.
Yeah, so a lot of times once people start collecting Social Security early on, they might realize, hey, maybe it wasn't the best idea to start collecting early. The money's not, playing out the way I thought it would in retirement. My income's not, where I think I need to be, especially if they're thinking about considering going back to work. If it's in the first 12 months, you can actually withdraw your application. You do have to pay it back, but you can withdraw your application as if you never took it, It's a one-time rule, and then you can kind of reset the clock on those benefits and get the increasing benefits, and then look to organize a strategy that would make a little bit more sense for the situation.
I guess that's where you talk about the possibility that you can kind of revisit this at some time in the future, and the longer you wait, the longer you can hold out, not having to use your Social Security benefits. It does help out, too, in the long run, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, a lot of times people don't realize how much they're giving up and realize that a lot of the incidental expenses, you know, are still there. They think they're going to be able to trim the budget. They can't. And, yeah, they just need to rethink what their original process was going into it. And for those that are beyond that year, you can stop payments, but you have to wait until your full retirement age, which for most people is going to be around 66, but again, you could stop it at that point and then look to increase your benefit at a rate of 8% per year after that until age 70.
That's great. How do spouses fit into all of this? We talk about survivors and widows and the like, but we don't always talk as much about spouses. They, of course, will be able to earn some Social Security benefits as part of what you may happen to have. How do you work all those things out?
Yeah, so the spouses are what really a lot of the planning and the different options, you know, begin to multiply, become a little bit more complex, because a lot of people will evaluate their Social Security based on break-even points with whole numbers, which we already talked about. You have to consider net dollars. You know, it's always about what's coming in, not what the gross check looks like. But when it comes to the spouses, one of the things I always have to consider and tell my clients they have to heavily consider is when collecting those benefits, there's a very good chance if both spouses have reached retirement, that one of those spouses is going to live well into their 80s, given the current life expectancies. And so a lot of people say, well, we'll break even points at 75 or 78. I'm not going to wait that long.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of times when you're having a spouse and coordinating those benefits, you really need to consider potentially at least one of those being delayed, because that benefit ultimately ends up with the survivor, which means it's probably going to be well into 20, 25 years.
I know you also talked, too, about making sure, and we kind of alluded to this earlier in our conversation, about the fact that Social Security is really should be designed to be part of a whole comprehensive plan for your retirement. Tell us where that fits in.
Right. So when we talk to folks about collecting Social Security, distribution stage of money is a little bit different than accumulation. How your taxes are impacted are directly determined by some controllable events that you do in your retirement or you set up in your retirement. What I mean by that, Chris, real simply is, you know, when we have wages, it's 100% taxable. We're never going to tell somebody to pay us less. But how you choose to collect your income in retirement, how you choose to have those assets positioned, be it traditional type IRAs versus Roth IRAs, collecting money from pensions or not having pensions, from taxable accounts, non-taxable accounts. There's a thing called provisional income in the Social Security world. And the very simple version of what I'm trying to explain is how things show up on your tax return directly determine how much of your Social Security you're going to have to report as income and ultimately pay taxes on. And then also once you start that Social Security, it's going to change the tax impact of your withdrawals from your qualified plans. So you literally could be talking about thousands of dollars in taxes just depending on how you are setting up your income stream and just having enough understanding of how all those things intertwine and the cause and effect of all the things that you do moving into retirement. And it's new for everybody. So, you know, it's easy to make mistakes. You've never had Social Security, never had to claim it. You know, you've never had to start distributions for most folks, and all that newness, so to speak, creates you know, potential mistakes that, you know, could cost that consumer a lot of money and tax implications that they may have easily been able to avoid.
Well, finally, Greg, how secure is Social Security these days? We hear a lot of stories and see a lot of things in the media about this. A lot of people are very, very concerned about the fact that Social Security is going to go bankrupt soon. It's not quite soon.
Yeah. Well, and the one thing just to clarify, because the big knowledge out there, the exposure that it is the trust fund. And the trust fund is expected to run out of money sometime around the 2034. But the trust fund is actually the surplus that was created over the last several years. Social Security is what they call a pay-as-you-go system, which basically means it was never designed to have an account to pay for benefits. It was always designed for the people working to pay for those receiving benefits. And when it was originally designed in 1935, nobody anticipated life expectancy to go from late 60s to mid-80s. And so under the current program, without reform, which I anticipate that they'll continue to reform, we're seeing it already, it will be about 77 cents on the dollar when the trust fund is exhausted. So the current workforce would be able to support about 77% of the benefits. But they're making changes, as you know. What used to be 65 is now 66 or 67 for a lot of folks, and they'll continue to increase the amount of Social Security taxes that are going to be paid, and I'm hard-pressed to believe that they won't continue to, you know, reform that program because it does represent such a substantial part of a lot of folks' income.
Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer, as always, thanks for being with us and thanks for the advice.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This morning, Mayor Karen Freeman-Wilson, Councilman-at-Large Ronald Brewer, Police Chief Larry McKinley, Fire Chief Teresa Everett, and the men and women of the Gary Police and Fire Departments held a memorial service on the front steps of City Hall to remember not only those who died on September 11, 2001, but to honor Gary Police and firefighters for their heroic efforts every day. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with City spokesperson LaLosa Burns about the significance of today's event.
As we know, this is the 16th anniversary of one of the deadliest days in our nation, and the City of Gary will join many other cities across our nation in remembering those first responders, EMTs, firefighters, police, others that were on the front line during those terrorist attacks on our nation in 2001, and of course the families and the victims that suffered during that tragic day. So the city has been hosting such an event since the fifth anniversary of this tragic situation in our nation. Our salute to our Gary public safety personnel will also be a focus, and our first responders as well. And our mayor and our Gary Common Council each year say that this is a day that we should all remember in our city.
Were any people from Gary killed in 9/11 or injured?
There were some families attached to the City of Gary, and some of our own public safety personnel did go to the site of the tragic situation in New York City and also the other areas that were affected. So they did support by traveling there. We always look for at least 100. It's very early in the morning, but when you include all of our public safety officers that should be there and those in the surrounding areas here downtown, we could, you know, reach higher numbers. So we just expect people to just come out from the immediate vicinity and just look forward to, once again, as we do each year, paying tribute to those that were affected by 9/11 16 years ago. It's a national occasion, and it's similar to the fact of, and even Independence Day, you know, it's a tradition when we hold Independence Day events. So this is one of those that has affected the nation. It has affected individuals locally, and it is a day that so many individuals were hurt by this incident that we just feel that it is worth saying thank you to those that were out there on the front line and to, again, not forget those that were affected, the victims and those families that perhaps their lives would change tragically after this event. We just invite everyone to come out. That is, perhaps, if there's nothing occurring for 9/11 in your community or your neighborhood, or we invite all to come, not just Gary residents, but those that would just choose to come and just have a moment of silence and just remember once again.
The City of Gary spokesperson, LaLosa Burns. There's a recent article in the online publication of The Conversation that is a conversation in itself, and asks the question whether Americans really should be allowed to deduct any charitable gifts from their taxes and at least list them on their taxes. And let's find out more about that from the fellow who wrote the article. We have IUPUI Professor Patrick Rooney, who is also a member as well of the Center for Philanthropy at the IU Purdue Indianapolis. Thank you very much for being with us today, sir.
Thanks, Chris. Happy to be here.
Give us an idea of what prompted you to come up with the article that is in the conversation and your thoughts here behind making it easier for people to put charitable gifts on their taxes.
Well, so we were hired by Independent Sector, which is a nonprofit that does advocacy work for other charities throughout the United States. And they asked us to look into trying to measure what would be the impact of some of the proposals that have been discussed, such as lowering the top marginal tax rate and increasing the standard deduction, what impact that would have on philanthropic giving by households and individuals. And then, you know, one of the things that wasn't part of the current law but has been part of the law in the past was to allow a kind of above-the-line or below-the-line deduction for charitable contributions by individuals so that whether, even if you weren't an itemizer, you could still deduct your charitable gifts. And one of the reasons we were interested in that is, you know, more people give every year than vote. And so philanthropy is very democratic, small d. But we also wanted to see what would happen if we had the same tax incentives available to everybody, whether they were an itemizer or not. And so by democratizing the incentives to give, what impact that would have on philanthropy as well.
If you will give us an idea of where the tax system lies right now for those people who might be interested in making charitable gifts and why it seems to be against anybody on say, the lower end of the economic spectrum.
Yeah, so right now, if you are a non-itemizer, that is, you don't itemize your tax deductions when you file your tax returns, then it costs you basically a dollar to donate a dollar. So mm-hmm. you're not disadvantaged, but you're not given any tax incentive to do so. And the charitable tax deduction has been a part of the tax code for 100 years this year, and almost as long as the tax, you know, as we've had taxes. And so there's been a recognition that charitable donations play an important part in how we address our civil society needs around the country and around the world. And but if you're an itemizer, and let's say you're in the top marginal tax bracket, which today is 39.6%, if you know, let's round that to 40%. Mm-hmm. So if you donate a dollar, you get a 40% tax deduction. So it costs you 60 cents to give a dollar as for an itemizer in the top tax bracket. Whereas if you're a non-itemizer, it costs you a dollar to give a dollar. And so it does provide an incentive. Now, people don't give just because of the tax incentive, and I want to really stress that because that would be irrational to do. People, if you only cared about yourself, then you'd always be better off just keeping the money and spending it on yourself or your loved ones. But the tax incentives provide, the tax deductions provide an incentive to give at all, and to give more for those who do give, and we find that it does make a difference.
We see that, I guess, there are a number of reasons, that, of course, there are obvious reasons, we hope, like public broadcasting, for example, that why people should be making some kind of charitable gift to help out in here. But I'm sure there are probably a lot of areas as well that get discouraged from receiving any charitable gifts because of the way the system is now, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I want to say that, yeah, so public broadcasting, whether it's NPR or PBS, you know, are certainly, you know, legal tax-deductible entities and have received lots of small donor gifts over the years and have received from some very famous large ones over the years as well. And, you know, I think that the tax deductibility provides some marginal or incremental incentive for individuals and families to give at all, and for those who are giving to give more. Now, that said, it's the other households don't have, I would say they don't have a disincentive, but they don't have any tax incentives mm-hmm. to give more if they're not an itemizer.
Okay. We know that during the past campaign, then-presidential candidate Donald Trump talked about making some changes. What do you see the way things look now that we should be putting out there to safeguard any charitable giving that's offered?
Well, I think this is, you know, one of the challenges, and there are other reasons for these proposals, and so I don't want to say that they're all bad ideas per se, mm-hmm. But what we looked at was what would be the impact on charity. So, you know, what we know is that if you lower the top marginal tax rate from 39.6% to 35%, which has been proposed, that that would reduce giving by charitable giving by just under 1%. So that has a negative impact. It's not huge, but it's small, but it's negative, and it's real. The bigger one is the proposal to more than double the standard deduction. So right now, about 30% of households are itemizers, and under the proposed reforms, the number of itemizers would fall to 5% or 3% of households, depending on the actual law that's passed. Well, what we found is that by doubling the standard deduction, that would reduce charitable giving by almost 4%. And, you know, that's a very material amount. You might say that's not the end of the world, but that's 4% per year going on forever. And so I think that that's, you know, that's something to be concerned about. That's more than the amount of increase in charitable giving in most years. And so, you know, I think it would be a material loss. Another proposal that the Trump campaign has promulgated is to have the repeal of the estate tax. We did not look into that as a part of this research, but prior research has suggested that repeal of the estate tax would reduce charitable bequest giving by between 12 and 22%. So, again, that's hard to estimate because you give every year, but you only die once, right?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right.
It's more difficult to estimate those impacts. But again, all of these things would have a negative impact on philanthropy. Now, it might, you know, there might be motivations for doing them for other reasons, but we just wanted to alert people to the negative impact. On the other hand, if you expanded the charitable itemizer for charitable deduction for non-itemizers, we estimated that that would increase giving by 4.3%. So that would have a very positive and stimulative effect on giving because, again, that would create an incentive for all households to give from a tax perspective, regardless of whether or not they itemize.
Well, so it sounds like this is just one of the many reasons why we hope that the Trump administration will turn out some kind of tax reform proposal here before too long. We'd like to see certainly what would affect our taxes, we pay have to pay to Uncle Sam, but also affecting these charitable gifts that we like to give as well, too. We've been talking with Professor Patrick Rooney. He teaches at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He's also a member of the Center for Philanthropy there on the UPUI campus. Professor Rooney, thank you for taking time to talk with us about this, and we hope we do get some indication from Washington what they're going to do soon as far as the tax structure and how we can be able to safeguard our charitable gifts that we do give to whatever cause it may happen to be. Thank you for being with us today to talk about it.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
And on this Monday, it's time for another edition of Eye on the Arts with John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kevin Bellamy, who is Director of Administration at the Toll Theater in Hammond. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
You have been on the stage ever so many times at the Toll Theater and many other places as well.
Yeah, actually over about 100 times.
I was going to ask, have you kept track of how many?
I did.
When did you do your first show?
Second grade. Oh, you mean at the Toll?
Well, I was a grown-up, you know, like when when you were off on your own.
Probably after college then, I guess.
Yeah.
I did it up and through high school and then through college also, but more steady after college.
100 shows. Yeah. More than 100.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So are you in the next one at Toll Theater?
I am not.
Hypnosis, it's called, right?
Correct.
And, well, give us a little summary of what it's about.
Well, it's about a washed-up stage hypnotist, and he unknowingly picks an audience member who is one of the cast members, Alan, to be in his stage show. Everyone has a good laugh at his expense. Everyone goes home. Everything seems fine. Alan, the gentleman who was under on stage, has other ideas for the stage hypnotist, which I don't want to give too much away, but it involves possibly robbing a bank.
Is it a revenge plot?
No, it's a greed plot.
A greed plot.
And the stage hypnotist and the wife kind of have a collusion. The stage hypnotist and the husband have a collusion, the wife and the husband. So it's kind of cat and mouse and finding out who wins in the end.
And it's comedy and drama combined,
correct?
Right? Yeah. And it's so it's psychological.
Yes.
Is it a thriller?
We call it a comedic thriller.
A comedic thriller. Well, that's a good title for it. And Mark Baer from IU Northwest is directing, right?
That is correct.
And has Mark done other work with you?
Yes. He directed Nightmare Room a couple seasons ago and also Perfect Wedding.
And this show is going to be opening when?
We open September 8th, and it runs through September 24th.
Okay. So how many performances? Is that like 9 performances?
10.
10, okay.
Yeah. We do one Thursday night also.
Oh, yeah. You have your educator night.
Yeah. Industry night.
Industry night.
Yes.
I knew you called it something. how large is this? A small cast? Just the three characters?
Just the three.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. I like that Woody Allen movie that came out, I don't know, like what, 3 or 4 summers ago. Oh, 3 or 4 years ago, and Colin Firth played. It was a similar kind of a thing where there was a magician, and it was more like vaudeville era. It was in Britain. It was in London, maybe. It seemed British to me at the time.
This one is British too. So,
they all seem. You know, they do good psychological comedic thrillers. They so do. There you go. What else is going on at the Toll these days?
Well, after we close. Hypnosis, we will open Heathers, the musical high school edition with our Toll Youth Theater Ensemble, mm-hmm. which will run in October, the mm-hmm. last 2 weekends in October, and that is based on the 1980s Heathers movie.
Heathers movie.
Did you ever see it?
No.
Winona Ryder, Christian Slater. Oh, it's a cult classic.
I see. It's not a cult that has been on my radar. A cult experience I've missed. You know, a lot of cult experiences I miss. I'm so out of that loop.
It kind of deals with bullying and high school cliques and the hierarchy in high school and revenge.
Oh, that sounds perfect for your young people's group. Yeah. Oh, that sounds fun. How many kids will be involved in that?
20.
Oh, my gosh.
Big cast.
Yeah. Oh, that's fun, though. That gives a lot of... So the young people who are involved in your group, where do they come from? All over?
All over. We've got kids from Chicago, Crown Point, Valpo, Munster, Griffith, Highland. Uh-huh.
And how often do they get together to rehearse?
They will rehearse probably 3 to 4 nights a week.
Mm. Wow. So that's quite a commitment.
Yeah, it is.
Schlepping to downtown Hammond all that many times. And then you've got, is Hypnosis your last main stage show of the year?
Yes.
And then you have the fabulous 50s
Christmas. Correct.
And you used to be in that once upon a time.
Once upon a time.
Do you still do it some years?
No,
not so much.
Mm-mm. No, it's just, it's a lot to handle being on stage and doing everything else.
Oh, so. It is. You guys, you and Jeff do a really great job there.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Kevin, thank you for being here to tell us about Hypnosis. And we'll have you or Jeff back sometime soon to talk about what's going to come up in 2018.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Kevin. Thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And John King with Eye on the Arts talking there with Kevin Bellamy of the Toll Theater in Hammond about the current running of the play Hypnosis. And you can hear this and other editions of Eye on the Arts online right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and join us next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow we'll have a conversation with Indiana economist, writer, and speaker Morton Marcus. He has a number of the Eye on the Pike columns we can talk about. I hope you'll join us for that.